this court, draw near, and you shall be heard. God bless the United States and this honorable court. Please be seated.
Thank you. Good morning, University of Pittsburgh. I'm Chief Judge Castle. To my right is Judge Scholin. To my left is Judge Greenberg. We're here today in the matter of James Knorr, docket number 13-1321. Counsel of the parties, please note your appearance for the record.
Robert Chisholm on behalf of Mr. Knorr, and with me is Matt Palacco, also the law firm of Chisholm and Chisholm.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honor. Drew Simon on behalf of the Secretary of Veterans Affairs, along with the Council Stable of Scott Bassett, Jr.
Thank you. Are both parties ready to proceed?
We are.
Each party will have 30 minutes to present argument. Mr. Chisholm, do you reserve time for a rebuttal?
I would like to reserve 10 minutes for rebuttal, Your Honor.
Have it, and you may proceed.
Your Honor, it's fundamentally unfair for the VA to slam the door shut on a claimant who seeks information relevant to his claim. He needs that information in order to meaningfully participate in the process. A veteran should be allowed to peek under the hood and look at a negative medical opinion obtained by the VA and controlled by the VA. The need is particularly compelling here because the burden is on the VA to rebut the presumption of soundness under 38 U.S.C. Section 1111. In this case, specifically prong 2 of Section 1111. We maintain that the fair process doctrine and the due process doctrine, two interrelated concepts, should permit Mr. Knorr to peek under the hood.
The fair process. May I ask you, Counselor, why are you settling for a peek? Why don't you open the hood and see it all? Why shouldn't every rule of discovery under the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure apply to veterans' proceedings such as this, particularly in as much as at this stage, that is, at the board, it's non-adversarial?
Right. And I would submit that what we're seeking specifically in this case is the least intrusive means to do that, to peek under the hood or look under the hood, and that is through targeted interrogatories at an adverse medical opinion, Your Honor.
Have you abandoned your request then for an alternative of a subpoena to bring the doctor to a hearing?
I wouldn't say we've abandoned, Your Honor. In our pleadings below, we asked either for the opportunity for interrogatories or alternatively for the opportunity to ask questions of the examiner, Dr. Feng, at a hearing, and the board rejected both of those in its decision.
Do you continue to seek the opportunity for a subpoena?
In the alternative, we would seek an opportunity. In other words, if we're not able to ask interrogatories, we would seek an opportunity to talk to the doctor and ask questions, yes.
You have stated that the doctor wrote a negative opinion and you'd like to peek under the hood. Does that mean that you believe that the opinion contained ambiguities?
I think it does contain one major ambiguity, because at the end of the opinion on the record at page 53, Dr. Feng writes, "Respectfully, while I recognize my personal limitation, the board should seek the next expert opinion if this examiner's report is still not sufficient or satisfied by the board review." It's unclear what she means by personal limitations. Does that mean everything she said earlier in the opinion shouldn't be taken at face value?
Does that make the opinion inadequate then, and why couldn't we just find that?
It could make the opinion inadequate, and yes, you could find that. But at the point in the proceedings where we were representing Mr. Knorr below, we had no idea what that meant. The board refused to ask any questions to the examiner, so we submitted our own questions to the examiner to try and ascertain exactly what that provision meant.
Well, isn't it worse than that? I mean, this opinion doesn't even recite the time-honored concept of to a reasonable degree of medical certainty, the doctor finds, and that would invite a further inquiry from you as to what is part of your 11 questions.
Yes,
it would. Inferentially, on what factual basis did you come to your expert conclusion?
Yes, that is correct. I agree with that statement as well.
Mr. Chisholm, would you go to the actual interrogatories that you submitted?
Yes, Your Honor.
Now, in this non-adversarial proceeding that occurs down in VA, there is no specific provision for a veteran to submit interrogatories. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Regulations.
There's no regulation or policy or procedure at this time.
But there are regulations regarding going out and getting documents and aiding and assisting the veteran.
That is correct.
So when you go through your interrogatories, you wanted a copy of the curriculum vitae.
Correct.
And you could have just asked for that.
That is correct.
In a sense, you did here, but you put it in the form of an interrogatory.
That is correct.
And in number 4, 5, 6, and 7, you're asking for documents, are you not?
That is also correct.
And they could have been asked as a request to get these documents.
That is correct.
And in number 8 and 9, you're asking questions of, and 10 and 11, you're asking questions regarding the words that were used by the doctor in this case.
Right. And I think the only means to get the answers to those questions is to have the opportunity to talk to the doctor, either through these interrogatories or through the subpoena procedure.
And if you had not put it in the form of an interrogatories and had requested these particular documents, do you think you would have gotten them?
I don't know the answer to that, Your Honor. In other cases, we've had some success, but that's not in the record.
Did you make an argument to the board that these words were subject to more interpretation or various interpretations?
Well, I think that's – no, I did not make that specific argument to the board, but I think it's implicit in the questions that we're asking to raise the flag that there's some concerns with this opinion, and the board should have either asked these questions themselves or alternatively allowed us to ask them.
But if you had told – if you had gotten – presented a different argument and didn't ask for interrogatories, mm-hmm. but rather said, I would like these documents, this is why – and said, and by the way, they use these terms in here, and I think they're subject to multiple interpretations, and suggested what those might be, and I believe that the board needs to gather more information on that and certainly address it. Would that not fall under the normal regulations?
That could definitely fall into the normal regulations. That's correct, Your Honor.
And then you wouldn't be facing a constitutional issue.
That is correct. The problem.
But why couldn't the board just take your list of questions, as the Chief Judge has just enumerated them, turned it into a request under the duty to assist, and gone out and gotten them? You would have had your due process, at least the due process that you sought.
Yes. They chose not to do that. They could have done that, and in many cases they do seek clarification, either from remands for this court or in their own regular process where they get an exam that has some ambiguity in it. And so we tried to point that out, at least to raise the flag here and peek under the hood to see what the doctor actually meant in her opinion, and they refused to grant Mr. Knorr that opportunity.
How did you know it was a she?
I later determined that it was a she from the VA's website, Your Honor.
If the court were to find that there was some right, be it statutory or regulatory or constitutional, to interrogatories, how would the number be limited, or should it be limited?
I do think it should be limited, to answer that question. I think that is not necessarily an issue the court has to resolve today, but what I will say is if there is a constitutional right, and we believe there is, to ask interrogatories in this situation, the VA can, through regulation, notice, and comment, promulgate a regulation that would outline the parameters of interrogatories to be submitted to an examiner who renders an adverse opinion.
Would you posit that the right to submit interrogatories would not be limited just to independent medical experts or VA medical experts in the context that you've been in, but also to CMP exams as well?
Yes, I would. And the reason I say that is many of the CMPs now are under the DBQ, and they don't have much explanation to them how the doctor arrived at their opinion as to nexus, for example, or as to why a particular veteran can't work due to his or her service-connected disabilities. Those opinions we would submit, to the extent they're adverse, the veteran should have an opportunity to ask questions in that situation as well.
So you're not relying on the distinction that Dr. Fang was a non-examining physician offering an opinion as opposed to an examiner who actually interacts with the veteran?
I think you could draw that line, but no, I'm not asking you to draw that line.
Would you distinguish your case from Gamble?
Yes. I think the difference between Gamble and this case, in Gamble, Mr. Gamble never raised the interrogatories at the agency level as we did. As Mr. Knorr reviewed, as his counsel reviewed the medical opinion, he raised specific questions directed to the examiner. In Gamble, they were looking for a broad right for the first time in court, having not attempted to ask any questions or challenge the
but the Federal Circuit didn't
at the
go,
agency level.
The Federal Circuit didn't rely on that, did they? They found no prejudice.
They did find no
prejudice. How do you distinguish the no prejudice finding in that case where the evidence was against the veteran in that case, and he submitted no evidence showing a nexus in that case? How do you distinguish that from your case?
Here, as I said in my opening line, the burden is on the VA to rebut the presumption of soundness. And this is the opinion, Dr. Feng's opinion, is the one that they are actually relying on to rebut the presumption of soundness.
So just because we're here at law school, the presumption of soundness is attributed to a veteran when they join the service if a disability injury is not noted on the records when they enter service. That can only be rebutted by clear and unmistakable evidence that the disability you had pre-existed service, and clear and unmistakable evidence that it was not aggravated from service. So in that context, you're finding a difference in this case because the burden is effectively on VA to demonstrate there was no aggravation.
That is correct. We conceded as to prong one that the condition did pre-exist service, but it's still the VA's burden to also rebut prong two, that there's clear and unmistakable evidence that it was not aggravated, because Dr. Feng's opinion attempts to address that issue, and we believe fails in that attempt. It is why we are seeking these interrogatories, and it's what distinguishes this case from Gamble on the issue of prejudicial error.
What weight should we give to the fact that Congress considered interrogatories and rejected them in the legislative history of the VJRA?
I think you can give it some weight, but clearly the process has evolved since the VJRA in 1988. When Congress enacted the 2006 statute, and I can't think of the technical name of it, it's not coming to my mind, but that allowed counsel to represent veterans after a notice of disagreement, where before you could only represent and charge a fee after a final board decision, the Congress specifically recognized that the process had become more, had evolved. And as part of that evolution, and also with the Veterans Claims Assistance Act mandating that the VA go out and get exams once a substantially complete application is submitted, we think the process has evolved and a veteran should be able to ask questions of an examiner.
Well, on that score, did the Administrative Procedure Act of 1946 contain explicit descriptions of what discovery could or couldn't be had of an administrative agency? And shouldn't we be looking to that as an exemplar of the limits, if there are any, of discovery?
Yes, as to the Administrative Procedures Act. And yes, I think you can look to that as an exemplar. You can also look to the Social Security process. And Social Security has found a number of the circuits that have ruled on this, specifically that a Social Security applicant should be able to ask interrogatories and or have the right to cross-examination.
What's the line between a court reviewing a scheme that has been set up by Congress in statute and given authority to the Secretary to write regulations with regard to that, and some Supreme Court decisions in this area addressing due process? What's the role of a court to step in and grab from a 1940-some-odd APA statute and apply it and superimpose it on top of the statutes and regulations that exist for VA?
Well, I think that's exactly what we're asking you to do here, first of all, to be clear. We're asking you to superimpose this because the board is not going to do this willingly based upon its decision here. So I think you can look to these other sources, the APA, you can look to Social Security, and use those to fashion a remedy here, which is the opportunity for a veteran to ask.
But I thought you answered in response to my question earlier that the remedy already existed. You could have asked for these documents, and you could have pointed out to the board what you perceived were words that had various interpretations and laid that entirely on the record. Could you have not?
I did not exactly say that, I believe. What I said, or if I did say that, I meant to say, the remedy he seeks is the opportunity to ask the questions himself when the board refuses to ask these questions.
What if the board had asked the questions and forwarded them on?
Then I think due process is probably satisfied in that situation once the interrogatories are presented to the examiner and we get the responses.
So you're not arguing about the specific form. You were rejected by the board as to the form or format that you chose to ask the questions. But you're saying you would have been satisfied if the substantive material you sought were obtained in any other way through the board.
But if there were an absolute
right?
Well, I'm sorry.
Yes, that is correct, Judge Greenberg.
Right.
If there were an absolute right, though, to submit interrogatories, would the board member be within their authority to say, no, we've already asked the questions, we're not going to undertake further interrogatories from you?
And then we'd be right back here if we weren't satisfied with that response. But I think the answer is, whether we ask the questions or they're channeled through the board, the questions would get answered. And here they haven't been answered, and Mr. Knorr hasn't been given that opportunity.
That dovetails into my next question, which is the burden on the system. Is there going to be collateral litigation as to you didn't allow me enough interrogatories, the answers to the interrogatories weren't responsive enough, and how is that going to happen, and where would such a litigation occur?
That's a fair question, and I think the answer is presently in the Social Security world, there really hasn't been a lot of litigation over the amount of interrogatories or the questions. If the VA, through notice,
they limit the interrogatories in the Social Security world?
I don't know specifically whether they limit them. Excuse me. But in doing some research on just that point, there's not a lot of collateral litigation. I think if the Secretary, through notice and comment, promulgates a regulation and all stakeholders would have the opportunity to comment on that, then a process would be set up. But I don't think the process is going to be set up absent action by this court.
Well, right now, VA has the authority through statute to issue subpoenas, and the subpoenas can be enforced in district court.
That is correct.
So would you imagine something similar would be appropriate?
I would imagine that they could look to Rule 33 of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure to sort of get an idea of how interrogatory is used generally in federal litigation. And then come up with a process that either the questions are directly submitted from the veteran or the veteran's representative or channeled through the VA, either the VA or the board. I would imagine either one would be sufficient.
Now, describing all this procedure and then as well as the doctor's time in responding or whoever the person is that's interrogatories are being submitted to, there's a lot of headlines right now about the workload that VA is facing. Doesn't that government interest overwhelm the private interest here in providing a little more process when there already is a lot of process?
There certainly is a lot of process in the system already. The problem here is, and why the process, this specific process is needed, is the VA controls the development of the record, obtains an opinion that is adverse and negative to the veteran, and at that stage, his only opportunity is to do one of two things, really. It's to get a rebuttal opinion, which can be fiscally challenging for many veterans who are indigent, or to have a witness and have a hearing. But what hearing and rebuttal opinion is going to specifically undermine the opinion of Dr. Feng? And that opinion, the board can choose over the opinion of, say, a rebuttal examiner. And the review of that in this court is very limited. So what we're seeking here is the ability to ask questions of an adverse exam.
Aren't you really saying, wouldn't you agree that none of these 11 questions that you've specifically put here are intrusive, should take any, put any burden on the doctor to answer? They're all quite specific to this case. The record should have all of these documents that you requested, A and B. Isn't it possible to approach this the way courts have approached it for at least since 1941, Federal Rules of Civil Procedure? Individual judges here, individual members of the board, construct a method of limiting the burden on the VA to answer questions. If you came in with 1,000 questions, per se, it would be unreasonable. We do that every day in courts, don't we?
I agree with both points, Your Honor. And I would just add,
what's the guidance from the Supreme Court with regard to addressing the constitutional due process if you can address it under statutory or even regulatory provisions that are provided?
The guidance,
and you've asked us to get to a constitutional issue as to whether or not the Constitution guarantees or requires that you be allowed to submit interrogatories that get passed on. As we discussed, you may have been able to ask for those documents under the regulations the Secretary has. You may have been asked them to get clarification, which the regulation talks about clarification for medical records. Could this case, if it can be decided under regulations that already exist, what's the guidance from the Supreme Court with regard to that?
Well, I think you're not supposed to decide a constitutional issue if there's another alternative means or grounds to do that.
So let me ask you the question in your 35 seconds. Why did you go to the Constitution instead of the regulations?
We went to the Constitution in this case because Mr. Knorr needed to get at this opinion and find out what it really meant. And the opinion raises too many questions to be satisfied through alternative means, as we've been discussing here. The only way to get at the truth of this opinion and the real facts of this case is to be allowed to answer these interrogatories, and that's why we chose this path.
But you agree we could reach a conclusion.
Time's up, but I'll add 2 minutes to answer your question.
Thank you. You agree that if we decided this case without reaching the constitutional dimension and provided a means for the substance that you seek, you'd be satisfied?
I would. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chief Judge Castle, to may it please the court. Secretary respectfully asserts that the VA benefits claimant has no Fifth Amendment due process right to use an evidentiary discovery tool such as interrogatories or to otherwise confront a VA examiner who provides a negative nexus opinion in the scope of VA's non-adversarial system.
Why not?
Your Honor, there's a number of reasons. The Supreme Court in Matthews v. Eldridge set forth the test for determining what process is due. The underlying issue is whether or not a claimant can be heard in a meaningful way and manner. And in this case, the Secretary asserts that he can. The three prongs of the Matthews test are that a private interest be affected by the official, or the private interest that would be affected by the official action, which here is low, the risk of erroneous deprivation of such an interest through the procedures used, which in this case is low, and the government interest, including the function involved in the fiscal and administrative burdens.
We're familiar with the case. What about these 11 questions interferes with that analysis? Why isn't this non-burdensome and fair to the veteran?
Your Honor, in this case, what the Secretary is pointing to is whether due process requires it. Now, a claimant can always request interrogatories. They can request a subpoena, and that determination can be made by the board, which it was in this case.
But whether the board said they didn't have authority.
Yeah.
Well, the board pointed out that there wasn't authority to allow for interrogatories insofar as there's not a statute.
Is there a statute for subpoena authority?
Yes, Your Honor, there is.
All right. Are interrogatories less burdensome than a subpoena?
Yes, Your Honor, it is.
So why would you think there's no authority to issue questions, which is what interrogatories are?
Sorry, Your Honor. While there's no authority, it's not to say it.
Why would you say there's no authority? Just because somebody didn't say specifically, oh, you can subpoena somebody, but I can't ask you a question.
When I say there's no authority, I mean that there's no statute that speaks to whether interrogatories. And in fact,
I understand that. You're not understanding me. If you have subpoena authority, what would make you think you don't have the right to ask a question?
The Secretary is not asserting that they do not have the right to ask a question, but there are procedures.
The board did, though.
I understand, Your Honor, but I think that what the board was saying was that there's no statute that provides for it, but that's not to say that these concerns can't be met through other procedural safeguards. And those procedural safeguards are numerous and allow appellant to be heard in a meaningful way.
Why didn't the board jump on that right away? Why didn't the board look at these interrogatories and say, geez, these are questions that you have, these are documents that you want, your interrogatories, I'm not going to forward them, but I'll get information on these. Why didn't the board do that? And should the board have done that?
I think the board looked at the interrogatories properly as they were requested to be submitted to Dr. Feng and found that they weren't necessary to make the determination in the case, Your Honor.
Well, let me jump in there for a second. One of the appellant's questions was to request the doctor's CV. How is that unreasonable? If the veteran were to question the doctor's competence, that would be a reasonable piece of information for the veteran to have. And if they don't question the competence at the board level, then they've waived their ability to do that.
Yes, Your Honor, but in this case, the Secretary asserts that appellant was not questioning the competence. They were looking, and on page 11 of his brief, appellant wrote that he was looking for a way to expose potential inadequacies.
Right. In other words, how is the doctor or how is the attorney supposed to determine whether the doctor is competent without first reviewing the CV, which could then raise a potential ambiguity or problem with the exam?
Your Honor, the court in Parks explained that the presumption of regularity applies to VA's choice of a doctor.
Unless questioned.
Pardon me?
Unless questioned by
Unless questioned, correct. And that under Rizzo, unless questioned, the competency is presumed. Here, appellant was not questioning the competency. He was looking for a way to expose a potential competency issue, but
would the board's decision then have been premature in that it didn't allow the appellant to present an argument? It only denied his interrogatories?
No, Your Honor. The Secretary would assert that it wasn't, because after Dr. Fangs provided her most recent addendum, a 20.903 letter went out, which provided for 60 days for appellant to present argument and to present further medical evidence, to request under the duty to assist that the Secretary go out and obtain other medical evidence that may be in existence, or to present anything to question the adequacy of the opinion. But instead of choosing that route, appellant, which are provided for in statute and in regulations, appellant, who is represented by Mr. Chisholm at the board, instead chose to ask questions to expose potential inadequacies.
Were those questions submitted within 60 days of the mailing of Dr. Fang's opinion?
I believe they were, Your Honor.
Did the board rule on the appellant's interrogatories prior to issuing its board decision?
No, Your Honor.
So the appellant wasn't given an opportunity to realize that their questions weren't going to be responded to prior to the board actually making a decision, so they couldn't have submitted additional argument that would have been raised by the responses to these interrogatories that they were anticipating.
The Secretary respectfully disagree with that. The 60 days provided were adequate for appellant to be heard and provides fair process and due process and allows him to make those arguments. He could have made them in the alternative. He could have said, he could have argued that the exam was inadequate or that Dr. Fang was incompetent for whatever reason, but he chose not to, and instead he looked to expose potential inadequacies. In other words, to go on a fishing expedition, which this court under duty to assist case law has said a fishing expedition is not what the duty to assist is for. Yeah,
but asking for a CV is a fishing expedition?
No, Your Honor, but, well, in a sense, yes, Your Honor, because as I stated earlier, Dr. Fang's competency is presumed. She provided her what her credentials were at the bottom in accordance with the Secretary's M21s, and there's no reason to question her competency.
Just a minute. The only two out of the 11 that I see as a fishing expedition is state your full name and place of employment and address. Everything else goes squarely to the substance of this case. Do you not agree?
No, Your Honor, I do not
agree. Well, what's wrong with asking for your most recent CV? Apparently, counsel found out the doctor was a female by going on some website. Why doesn't the VA just post all the providers of these services on their website?
I can't say what the policy is.
That's not burdensome. You handed in a CV to get the job, put it out to the public, number one. Number two, what about a copy of the handwritten notes during the interview with the veteran of July 30th, 2012? What's a fishing expedition about that?
Your Honor, the Secretary has a duty, and under the presumption of regularity, it's presumed that he followed it, to include everything relevant to appellant's case in the claims file. So that can be relied upon to indicate that there's nothing in existence beyond what's in the claims file that hasn't been included in the claims file. An appellant was seeking something that hasn't been shown to exist insofar as the notes, as he was seeking notes.
Exactly. He's asking, do they exist? And if they exist, I want to see them. Shouldn't he be entitled, as a matter, forget due process for a moment, just as normal everyday interrogations of expert witnesses? This doctor is testifying in the form of an opinion as an expert, and they're relying on that opinion to deny the benefit. What's wrong with these questions?
Your Honor, the Secretary asserts that these questions are not necessary to be heard in a meaningful way and manner, which is the test under due process. Appellant can ask, but the bottom line is, and this Court has made clear, that the competency is presumed, that there's no reasons or basis requirement to...
Judge Schoen just said unless questioned. This veteran is questioning inferentially or explicitly, and probably more explicitly, once they have this discovery, the competence of either the doctor or the sufficiency of the basis for the opinion. Surely you would agree that the Secretary must make those determinations.
As to competency?
Yes.
The competency, again, Your Honor, the Secretary relied upon this Court's case law that said that the competency is presumed and there's nothing...
Unless challenged. This veteran is challenging that.
And I believe that the Board correctly read the interrogatories.
If this had been in the form of a request to the Board member to secure the curriculum vitae of the doctor and the written notes taken during any review of the veteran's case and a copy of the interview, if it existed, what would the Board have said?
The Board, under its duty to assist, would have had to address whether that was proper and whether they needed...
So does this come down to a situation where counsel below, because he was represented below, I believe by you, Mr. Chisholm, put it in the form of interrogatories, and the Board only looked, which is kind of like your argument here today, only looked at the fact that it's interrogatories and you don't have to respond to interrogatories, and didn't go the next step, which are questions from all the judges up here, and say, geez, he's raising questions here. He wants these documents. Why don't I approach it from the standpoint of he's asked for these documents?
Irrespective of the label attached.
Irrespective of the label.
The Board could have done that, Your Honor, but as to the underlying issue as to whether due process requires the Secretary to allow for interrogatories, the Secretary still maintains that due process doesn't require it.
Well, does due process require an answer to the questions posed by these interrogatories? As the Chief says, what if they were questions? I request, please get me, under your duty to assist, under some other application of congressional intent, I need these to perfect my claim. You need to help me perfect my claim. Does it come in on an envelope, back of an envelope, full letter, list of interrogatories? What difference does it make?
Your Honor, in this case, there was not an argument made that anything was that the examiner's opinion was inadequate. As he writes in his brief on page 11, he was looking to expose potential inadequacies.
This might be the double-edged sword of having counsel down below. A veteran would have come to you and said, that doctor, he's crazy. But a counsel comes to you and says, before I call that doctor crazy, I would like to see some of the underlying information that might exist. So for the school here, counsel are involved in cases after the first RL decision. Regional office decision where they can be compensated. Prior to that, there's no compensation available and there's less involvement. But with attorneys being more involved in the practice, certainly the Secretary should understand that attorneys are going to want to seek information before they just assert that a medical opinion is inadequate, would you not think?
Potentially, Your Honor.
Would you agree that if this case can be decided on statutory or regulatory provisions that the court should go that route instead of addressing the full constitutional issue?
Yes, Your Honor. I believe the Supreme Court has made it clear that the constitutional argument should come secondary to that.
Well, I'd like to talk a little bit about VA's statutory authority for subpoena power.
Sure, Your Honor.
It's limited by statute and regulation to persons within 100 miles of the place of a hearing. The Board of Veterans' Appeals now conducts a tremendous number of their hearings by video conference. So is anybody really more than 100 miles from a hearing location if the veteran can be in location one, his service officer or attorney in location two, and the Board of Veterans Appeals in location three? What is the 100-mile radius that VA looks at?
The 100-mile radius would be from where the hearing would take place, but insofar as they could be provided through video conferencing, it's possible that if the test under 20.711 is met, that there can still be a hearing. Here, though, the board analyzed whether, and the test under 20.711 is whether there's necessary evidence that cannot be obtained in any other reasonable way. And here, the board explained that the questions that were provided did not rise to the level of necessary evidence that can't otherwise be obtained.
They also said that the doctor was not within 100 miles, though.
So. Yes, Your Honor. I think that is part of the analysis that's required under the board.
Well, why'd they go to Oklahoma City for a doctor for a San Diego veteran?
Your Honor, VA in every instance looks for the most qualified person whose expertise can be best utilized, and sometimes being that it's a national network of healthcare, that those examiners can be up to thousands of miles away.
Well, where'd you get the 100 miles? Where'd the secretary get the 100 miles from? Federal rules of civil procedure, I'll bet.
It's in the statute as well.
It's in the statute provided by Congress, Your Honor.
All the more reason, it would seem to me, to have someone within the 100 miles give this opinion.
Well, or...
Or explain that they don't exist, or explain...
Would the secretary stipulate that if it had been necessary under the statute, that a video conference location can be a place of the hearing?
I think that's possible, Your Honor, but I still think that the 100 miles should be taken into account based on Congress's statute.
So 100 miles of the doctor, who's the one being subpoenaed,
yes,
to a location where there happens to be video equipment?
Yes, Chief Judge.
And not the 100 miles of the board who decides not to fly out there and sits in Washington? And not the 100 miles of the veteran who's on a video down in, what'd you say?
San Diego.
San Diego.
That's my understanding.
I think that's Judge Sholin's question. Do you agree that it would be 100 miles of where the person being subpoenaed is located if they were being subpoenaed to, say, a district court that had video?
Or a VHA facility where Dr. Fang worked, say?
Your Honor, I don't know the answer to that. I apologize.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me ask you, where did this, for those in the audience also, one must understand that this Board of Veterans Appeals consists of a large number of persons, and frequently they sit in panels or individually. And this, and even though he calls himself a veterans law judge, Board of Veterans Appeals, he is, this Michael Lane, on this case, was a member of the Board of Veterans Appeals, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right. Where was Mr. Lane physically when he heard the evidence, considered the evidence, and wrote his opinion? Did he go to San Diego?
I don't believe so. I believe he was in Washington, D.C., Your Honor.
And where was, and was there a transcript made of the hearing?
Yes, Your Honor.
And it was a video hearing?
I believe so, but I apologize. I can check.
All right, so what impediment was there to provide the same sort of technology to get the answers to the questions posed from Dr. Fang in Oklahoma City? I mean, why didn't Mr. Lane consider these questions as reasonable and make his own independent inquiry of the doctor, other than the fact that the rejection was because they're in the form of interrogatories?
I believe that was the basis, is that they were in the form of interrogatories. They were questions and not argument. And that was how it was interpreted by the board, and the secretary asserts that that's proper. Your Honor.
All right, I think we understand. I think we've given you a lot of opportunities.
Well, I'd like to pursue something related to this. The secretary has regulations and their statute that permit subpoenas, but there are also regulations that prohibit cross-examination. How are those reconciled?
I'm sorry, can you repeat the question, Your Honor?
The secretary has regulations that permit subpoena.
Yes.
But they have regulations that prohibit cross-examination. if somebody is subpoenaed, say a VA doctor, wouldn't they be subject to cross-examination because in theory they've issued an adverse opinion, so they're not a friendly witness per se?
Your Honor, and the subpoena power is to be used, I think, if you look at Congress when they passed the statute for providing for subpoenas is to obtain evidence, evidence that couldn't otherwise be obtained. And when they talk about that, they talk about written evidence or potentially evidence that somebody would not provide, such as, for example, another veteran that has something documenting a matter that bears on the case. But here what we're talking about is Congress set up a system that was non-adversarial. And that non-adversarial system, they specifically excluded cross-examination, and they made a factual finding that would create an adversarial environment, and that was contrary to what they wanted to do. And under the Supreme Court explained in Walters that type of factual determination by Congress is entitled to a high amount of deference. In other words, once those adversarial mechanisms are interjected into the system, they would be contrary to the veteran's interest.
In Walters v. NARS, one of the things that seemed to weigh in the Supreme Court's decision was that it was a disability compensation case, so they analogized it more to Matthews v. Eldridge than Goldberg v. Kelly. What if Mr. Knorr was seeking pension, which is a needs-based benefit? Would there be a due process right in this case?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I haven't taken the time to analyze that, but no, I don't believe that there's a due process issue here because the procedural safeguards in place are adequate. The procedural safeguards start from the beginning with a duty to assist, providing a VCAA letter.
Yeah, we're familiar. Sorry to interrupt, but we don't have much time. So speaking of one of these safeguards, one of the things that VA can do is seek clarification from experts when the opinion, they perceive it to be ambiguous. And that those experts can be either VA doctors or private examiners. Why, if VA can seek clarification, why can't the veteran seek clarification?
The veteran can make argument that clarification is needed. In this case, that argument wasn't made. And in fact, as I stated before on page 11 of his brief, appellant was looking to expose potential inadequacy. In other words, there's not an inadequacy on the face of the examination.
Well, I'm talking conceptually as opposed to in this person's case. So if a veteran were to make such an argument, as you suggested, would the board have any obligation to go and seek clarification, or could they just tell the veteran, no, we don't think so?
I believe that the board would be required under the courts and the Federal Circuit's case law in Robinson to address an argument that was made. And where
right, but they could just say, we don't agree that it's ambiguous, or we don't agree that clarification is necessary, and the veteran would be without recourse at the VA, right?
I believe that the duty to assist explains it, or the bottom line with the duty to assist is that it's when there's evidence and it's necessary to adjudicate a claim. And here, if they made the determination, they would have to provide adequate reasons or basis, but they could say that the development wasn't necessary.
Well,
the duty to assist.
Sorry to interrupt. Let's take a look at the statute. The secretary shall make reasonable efforts to assist a claimant in obtaining evidence necessary to substantiate the claimant's claim for a benefit under a law administered by the secretary. Duty to assist.
That's
Act of Congress.
That's right.
What is either burdensome, inconvenient, inconsistent with that duty? Because counsel called it interrogatories versus some other means discussed up here.
Your Honor, to bring it back to the due process issue, appellant's argument is that interrogatories or the adversarial tool of confrontation are necessary in this case. And Your Honor asked about the burden on the government. The burden is great insofar as it would be providing interrogatories to interrogatories would be possible in all cases where there are VA examinations that are allowed, either to buttress the examination or to rebut an examination. And in recent testimony to the House Committee for Veterans Affairs, which I believe Your Honors can take judicial notice of, in 2013 there were close to 2.25 million CMP examinations provided. Now, the administrative burden in allowing interrogatories or cross-examination would be great on the government.
Well, that's a conclusion. You don't have any statistics to show that, do you? You don't have any comparable statistics from other activities of the federal government where interrogatories are allowed to show that, do you? Does the Secretary?
The Secretary.
It's a conclusion. Speculation, isn't it?
Well, Your Honor, I believe that the Supreme Court's case law is very clear that the fiscal and administrative burden can be taken into account, and that can be based upon the numbers provided.
Demonstrable burden. Has the Secretary demonstrated in this testimony that you're asking us to take judicial notice of? Testimony before a congressional committee? What are the statistics that show that asking questions, whether in the form of an interrogatory or a letter or a big sign that says, Mr. Secretary, under your statutory duty to assist, I would like the following documents.
Yes, Your Honor.
What's the evidence that that is burdensome?
I believe that the numbers illustrate that burden. And there's the other government interest is that President Obama has made it clear that the government's goal is to bring the backlog down to zero. Right now it's gone from 600,000 in March of 2013 to around 256,000 as of last month. And that would be negatively affected because
So soon VA will have lots of time when it gets to zero. Just kidding.
Yeah, well.
I wanted to pursue something that you talked about, the burden of proof. In this particular case, the burden of proof is opposite of what it normally is, in that it's on the Secretary. So does that make this proceeding adversarial in a way that the other sort of traditional service connection cases are not, in that the appellant is trying to disprove something that the Secretary has proffered as opposed to in a regular case where he has the burden to meet the evidence?
No, Your Honor. The Secretary asserts that this does not be an adversarial proceeding. The Secretary's duty to assist requires that it make a determination to get all the evidence that is necessary to adjudicate the claim. And under Section 7109, they went on and got an independent medical expert opinion to make a determination. And that determination by Dr. Feng was unequivocal, that there's absolutely no evidence that this claim, that this condition, that this thymic disorder was aggravated by service.
How do you respond to the appellant's contentions that since Walters v. NARS, the system has become more adversarial and more complicated?
Your Honor, the Secretary will point out that the VCAA, the Congress reaffirmed that this system is to be non-adversarial for the benefit of the veteran. And if this system were to become more adversarial via these tools, the Secretary asserts that it could be to the detriment of the veteran insofar as it would become a more adversarial system where the doctors were on guard, where they may have to hire attorneys to represent them in an adversarial proceeding where they were being cross-examination, which would in turn make it more difficult to even bring doctors to VA. The other aspect of the doctor side of that is that, and the burden on the government is that a lot of these examiners are contract attorneys that require significant oversight that would require additional oversight if they were required to be interjected into an adversarial proceeding as opposed to just even-handedly looking at the evidence and making a medical determination that could be adversarial to a claimant as well.
Is it less burdensome to have had an exam be conducted by an expert like Dr. Feng and then have a veteran like Mr. Knorr ask questions about the exam, which may satisfy any question as to ambiguity, as opposed to the veteran raising the question or raising the issue that the exam is inadequate because it's ambiguous, having to then potentially give the veteran a new exam?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I think that the system as it's set up is to the benefit of the veteran insofar as the claimant would be allowed to make his arguments, and if his arguments hold weight in the eyes of the board, that the board can go back and get a new examination or a clarification, as it did in this case after a JMR was filed by the parties. And after that, Your Honor, there is the additional level of review that, Your Honors, that the court provides and then the Federal Circuit. So,
but wouldn't all these additional steps that you've mentioned take more time and more resources from the agency, from the court, than merely having the doctor respond to a reasonable number of questions?
And, Your Honor, the administrative burden in promulgating regulations and providing internal guidelines and deciding what was adequate and what was not would be burdensome both on the agency and on the court. As Judge Bryson and Gamble in his concurring opinion wrote, providing these interrogatories, quote, would virtually ensure that the board, the Veterans Court, and this court would be collectively launched to an ongoing line-drawing process regarding the number and character of interrogatories that would be allowed. He goes on to explain that appellant would argue that the responses of interrogatories were inadequate, the follow-up interrogatories or in-person cross-examination was required, and he concluded that the overall burdensomeness of this process of proceeding down this road is clear. The Secretary agrees with that. It's a great burden on the government.
To the medical exam, the addendum that was submitted in this case, and your records, and you have been examined by a doctor who writes up an unequivocal opinion, as you say, and at the end of it he says, I recognize my personal limitations. Go get another expert if you need further information. And the appellant in his interrogatories asks, explain the phrase personal limitation. Would you not agree that an expert putting that at the end of his opinion raised an issue with regard to his scope of knowledge and expertise in rendering the opinion, while I recognize my personal limitation? Does that not raise an issue at all? If you got that, you'd be very happy.
Your Honor, I believe that what Dr. Feng was trying to say and the Secretary's reading of that is that she cannot make herself any more clear. She explained.
Now, if the board had taken this interrogatory and responded, we're not going to inquire further into that because this is our understanding of it, we'd have a regulation, we'd have the board referring exactly to what was being asked, and we'd have the board's view of that information and why they didn't go further, correct?
Your Honor, I believe my time is up.
Well, then good. Add 2 minutes, please.
Thank you.
That's the fun on being this side.
Your Honor,
I still think this is a case where you and the board focused on interrogatories and got your back up and said there's no regulations with regard to interrogatories and just didn't sit down and read what the veteran was asking you. Provide me these documents, and these are some issues that I have with this doctor's opinion. And the board could have gone through and addressed those issues, and we may have agreed with them or not, but at least we have an understanding from the board as to why, as opposed to we can't do interrogatories.
And, Your Honor, insofar as that would raise a reasons or basis problem, Your Honors can certainly read that as a problem and remand based upon that.
I understand. But I heard you. You're up here now trying to defend the due process requirement. Don't impose interrogatories on us. Keep it under the regulations. I hear you.
Took the words right out of my mouth.
I thought I did.
I do have one question. Under the 38 CFR 20.903, which provides claimants 60 days to provide a response to an IME, it states that response may include the submission of relevant evidence or argument. Could we read this to encompass something other than evidence or argument, such as particular questions?
Yes, Your Honor. I think that what this was an attempt to poke holes to expose potential weaknesses, as the appellant explained in his brief, as opposed
to. So if they had been actual questions, it would have been okay?
If they had made actual arguments or said that there was evidence missing or said that other evidence needed to be obtained that was out there that was favorable to his claim, that the VA could have gotten under his duty to assist, it would be a different case. But instead, he was asking questions to go on a fishing expedition, and that's.
No. Could you give me an example of what a permissible question might be?
A permissible question? He could have questioned whether there was something missing from the evidence, or he could have made a specific argument that something was inadequate, and that wasn't done here.
Okay, thank you.
Your Honor, if I may conclude quickly, the Secretary asserts, I believe you know where I'm going, the Secretary asserts that due process does not require a Fifth Amendment. The Fifth Amendment due process clause does not require interrogatories or otherwise confront, which
right,
is an
adversarial. Thank you very much.
Tool. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
If I may, just two quick points.
You confused the board and the Secretary by labeling these interrogatories and asking for information instead of just asking for the documents and pointing out what you perceive to be words that had multiple meanings and should be clarified.
Well, I think a fair reading of those interrogatories does just what you say, Your Honor. The presumption of regularity is being used by the Secretary as a shield to hide the ball on the expert. At this point in the process, the veteran should be able to meaningfully participate in the process. So once the adverse opinion comes out and there are questions about the opinion, he presents those questions, the VA should be required to respond. Whether we go the due process avenue, or as I think as the court has hinted here today, the duty to assist avenue, he should be allowed to inquire.
You would argue that the request for documents concern with the meaning of words within the doctor's statement were issues that were reasonably raised by your interrogatories, and if it's reasonably raised, the board should have addressed them more specifically.
Yes, absolutely, Your Honor. And with that, we would rest, Your Honor, if there's no more questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much. The case will be submitted. We will come down and greet counsel.